I'm Nancy Brow, and welcome to Liberal Lineup Updates and Unfiltered Insights. I'm joined by my good friend Kim Brown. I will let her introduce herself, and even better yet, we have Mina Bonsall, our good friend, who's going to be visiting and talking about, issues that are unique to women in the context of probably metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, although these conversations can go rogue. So Kim, I welcome you, and then let's hear from Mina.
Great. Thanks, Nancy. Just a little background. What spurred our interest in doing this podcast is we Mina and I had been together at a very nice advisory board, really focusing specifically on metabolic liver disease and women. And there's a lot of really interesting things I think that came out of that meeting. But more so, a lot of interesting things that I think we as hepatologists may not really be up to date on. So, Mina, thanks for joining us and updating us on all that's new.
Absolutely. I do think it was a great meeting. And I think the kind of framework to think about it is kind of your life from childhood to old age, like how women are maybe different and at increased risk at different times. And then, of course, because they have the privilege of having babies, how their health might impact the fetus, and then the life cycle continues, right? You have, you're born a girl, you get what I'm saying. So yeah. I think thinking about MASH in the context of a woman's timeline is really helpful and a great conversation to have.
Well, Mina, why don't you remind us as to where you are and what you do?
Sure. So I've been at Mount Sinai for 25 years, and I've held many hats in that time, including transplant hepatology fellowship director and a lot of administrative roles. But in 2022, we launched our MASH Center of Excellence, and that is really focused on MASH from basic science to clinical trials. And in 2024, I became the chief of the Division of Liver Diseases, and I'm at Mount Sinai, New York, if I didn't mention that in the beginning.
Excellent. And I'm certainly an international expert in fatty liver disease or MASH. I'm going to admit I did not have the privilege of going to the same conference where you guys became so educated, but I did learn that originally almost all of, women's health was extrapolated from studies that involved only men. So Mina, maybe we don't know the answer to this, but when did we start to recognize that, understanding how a woman's body works actually requires a woman?
Yeah, I'm not sure when the pivot point was, but certainly I think a lot of observations have been made. I mean, one being the increased risk of MASH in women postmenopausal. I mean, we're seeing trends in liver transplant, right? As we've cured hepatitis C, we've got Hep B under control, we're seeing rising prevalence of MASH as well as alcohol-associated liver disease. And when you look at MASH in particular, you can see that a couple years ago, it was the leading cause of liver transplantation. But I think after COVID, alcohol, they're kind of making a run for it. So they're probably pretty close. But I think that rate, once you end up with a liver transplant, right now you're saying, okay, wait a minute, how did we get there? And then you have to think about the fact that women are somewhat protected from MASH or fatty liver until they hit menopause, right? And then just like with cardiovascular disease, we kind of catch up to men when we hit that menopausal state. And I think that's really led to, a lot of now, let's go back and think about, wait, why are they now catching up to us? And the potential role of the changes in the hormonal status in increasing risk for everything. I think when I talk to patients, and me being postmenopausal, I can make this observation, you start to be in a situation where your waist might be slim and your hips are wide, and then you hit menopause and you start to collect fat around the abdomen and you're like, wait a minute, that never was an issue for me. And, we become a little like a male habitus when we lose estrogen. I always say, you know, I'm becoming more of an apple rather than a pear. And you see that. You see the women with the skinny legs and then, you know, kind of increasing around the abdomen as they get older.
Can I ask, Mina, you know, you talked about, you know, sort of the competing risk of MASLD and alcohol in our transplant population. I'm not aware, but are you aware of data where they've, you know, because of the increased risk of alcohol use in smaller amounts in women in general, right? Any specific information about, especially the postmenopausal woman and the interaction of alcohol in that population? Is it worse, better, the same? I'm just not aware that that population has really been specifically kind of pulled out to investigate.
I think women are at more risk of fibrosis mm-hmm. when they lose estrogen, right? So whatever the etiology of that injury is, the downstream kind of fibrogenic pathways are accelerated. Mm-hmm. So it's really the fibrosis that increases, whether it be alcohol or, you know, metabolic dysfunction driving the disease. You know, stellate cells express estrogen receptors, and so there could be anti-fibrotic effects there. Estrogen has positive benefits on mitochondrial function, on ER function, and so the loss of that is increasing, you know, that oxidative stress, the ER stress, and then downstream stellate cell fibrosis. So I think, and fibrogenesis. So I think it's the fibrogenic pathways that are kind of turned up and the injury pathways that are turned up when you lose estrogen.
Yeah.
I mean, the key question that begs to then, right. you know, that leads to, okay, if you're losing estrogen, yes. should we just give it back?
That's what I was going to ask.
I mean, I think that, you know, we've really come a long way in estrogen replacement therapy in the thoughts about it just globally. Like, we'll get to MASH, but like just thinking about estrogen replacement therapy, you know, a lot of the earlier studies kind of scared women, you know, to worry about breast cancer and strokes and, you know, clotting issues. But I think our thoughts on estrogen replacement therapy are evolving globally. And now much more emphasis on maybe thinking about its beneficial roles from a cardiovascular standpoint. And then we can talk about MASH. My understanding, though, is the data is really suggesting that, I'll get to MASH specifically, but just overall, you need to start it early to get the benefit. So I think recent studies have shown, you know, if you're going to do estrogen replacement therapy, because for you, you find it's beneficial, and of course, it's very personalized, then you should do it within the first few years to really get the maximal benefit. Once you pass 5 years, the risk-benefit ratio may be altered. When it comes specifically to MASH, we know that we don't know for sure that estrogen replacement therapy will help the situation. There's actually not good studies, and we need them. I can say that the route of estrogen administration may play a role, where transdermal estrogen has been associated with maybe an improvement in MASLD, whereas oral estrogen may be associated with an increase. So the data are so mixed that I don't think we can make a recommendation about estrogen replacement therapy to treat MASLD. And we need studies. We need well-controlled, randomized controlled studies to really tease this out better.
Certainly enough people out there that are perimenopausal that have risk factors for MASLD that you would think we should be able to answer that question. We just have to have a multi-center approach so that we can get that pulled together.
Absolutely. I mean, that's where we have to start to beat the drum to get these studies funded.
Yeah. No, I think your point's really well taken, because, you know, as Nancy pointed out, most of the literature that we have out there right now really involves, even if it doesn't involve women, it doesn't, you know, involve women at different stages, you know, in their hormonal life, right? And so just to say that, okay, well, we had women in the study and it applies to all women probably doesn't make a lot of sense for many diseases, certainly including MASLD, but.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I know that we started this by saying that, you know, MASLD is a spectrum across the life, you know, the life of the woman. But even if you look in the non-menopausal population, the, you know, of childbearing age, I would think that a person who's got polycystic ovary, that's a very different hormonal state than someone who doesn't. And we recognize that as a risk factor for MASLD. We recognize that as a risk factor probably for MASH. That, you know, we need to separate those individuals out, as that's not a good way of looking at a group of MASLD patients if you can't, you know, pull out those metabolic differentiators.
Yeah, absolutely. PCOS is definitely a known risk factor for MASLD and MASH, largely, I think, because of the insulin resistance that goes along with it as the primary driver. So yeah, for sure. And, you know, PCOS patients, that needs to be studied better, but certainly some of the pharmacologic treatments that are out there, which we can talk about, certainly, you know, it's based on fibrosis, right? So if a patient with PCOS has either a biopsy, but we don't usually need biopsies anymore, non-invasive tests for liver fibrosis consistent with, you know, stage 2 or 3 fibrosis, then certainly they should be put on one of the FDA-approved therapies. But I think the continuum, you know, we could talk a little bit about pregnancy, because last I checked, only women get pregnant, you know? So how is, you know, what happens there and what's going on? Because certainly with pregnancy, there's a lot of weight gain just inherent with pregnancy. But certainly we know, and I think Nancy, you've done some of this work too, that increased risk of in women who say are contemplate, let's take the, you know, you're contemplating pregnancy, and say you are living with some significant metabolic risk factors already, maybe obesity, maybe diabetes, you're already at increased risk of having MASH. Now you superimpose kind of the changes that happen with pregnancy, the weight gain, and now there's the potential for that worsening. So I think, and then I think the key is that there's a lot of data emerging that if you have MASH and you're pregnant, not only is there worse potential maternal outcomes like gestational diabetes, preeclampsia, there's then the impact on the fetus.
Yeah.
And more preterm birth, small for gestational age, large for gestational age if you have the gestational diabetes. And then I read, this was a while ago, and I didn't re-look at this study, but many years ago, there was a study about epigenetic changes. So if, you know, mom has this milieu, and then there's epigenetic changes in the baby that then confer in their lifetime an increased risk for diseases like MASH and diabetes. So kind of this whole full circle idea.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And, you know, getting back to like the young women with PCOS or even in our older patients postmenopausal, are the therapeutics the same? I mean, have they been adequately studied in those hormonal states to know efficacy, or were those people just were they excluded from the trials? Were they included, but, you know, put in with the masses? And any insight there?
Well, I mean, when you look at the clinical trial population, most are de facto postmenopausal, right? I mean, the average age in these studies is in the early 60s, right? So men or women, because women were probably slow until 50. And then from 50 to 60, they caught up to men. But once you, they're all looking, right? Because they needed to have the same fibrosis criteria to get into the study. we haven't followed them longitudinally to see when was that pivot point, right? But I think in the clinical trials, they're about 50-50 men and women. And so I do think that the therapies are, you know, picking up the are going to be equally effective. I've not seen any data to say either of the two approved therapies, semaglutide or resmetirom, are more or less effective in men versus women.
Yeah.
Kind of taking it on that, I have a lot of patients who, when they started their GLP-1, especially those that had PCOS, they found that their periods were more regulated, maybe a little bit less trouble with infertility. I wonder if you might start a metabolic younger person, like premenopausal or not menopausal, on a GLP-1 to see if it could more balance their hormonal status. Or maybe that's just another question. Is that something that would be, you know, does that make sense at all to think about?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think we need to study that more. I think that in a pre-pregnancy planning state, so sometimes obesity and some of these metabolic factors can increase infertility, right? I don't have the exact data or numbers, but people are told, oh, lose weight, right? And then, like you said, periods get more regular. You know, maybe they have an increased chance of getting pregnant. The challenge there is that the GLP-1s are contraindicated in pregnancy, and resmetirom hasn't really been studied. There's no huge signal in the mouse models for resmetirom for any kind of, you know, teratogenic kind of effects, but we really don't know. And so I think what the recommendation is that, say you're on a semaglutide for weight loss, or even, you know, tirzepatide, you're on some kind of weight loss medication in the pre-pregnancy planning stage, the recommendation is to stop it 2 months before you're starting to contemplate pregnancy. The challenge there is that what we don't know is then are you going to have like this rapid weight gain? You know, you've gotten to 2 months, right? Like before pregnancy, you've lost 20, 30 pounds. We know what happens in the non-pregnancy state, that within a year, 60% of that weight is going to come back at least, you know, and in the, now you're, you get pregnant, thank God, and now you're going to gain weight anyway. Like, are you going to like gain more weight now? Like, I think that's what we really need to understand, is that rebound weight gain in the context of pregnancy, better or worse than you were at the beginning? I don't know. We need to study that.
Yeah. Do you think we should have the same or different screening recommendations for women as compared to men, particularly at certain points in their life, or screening for PCOS, or, you know, monitoring them, particularly around menopause? Do you think we should just, I mean, right now we have fairly good guidelines in terms of, you know, screening recommendations and potentially follow up, but I think most of us, if we consider a patient at higher risk, maybe somebody who takes alcohol, or in this case, maybe somebody who's, you know, moving into menopause, that, you know, maybe the interval of monitoring should be different. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that key word was interval. Mm-hmm. So I think the screening recommendations for the at-risk population, right, the diabetes, the, you know, insulin resistance, the hypertension, high cholesterol, that I think we're okay. I think we should screen women for PCOS. Like, we need to ask women about PCOS symptoms, you know, hirsutism, irregular periods. If you see insulin resistance in a young person, you know, I think that a young woman, you know, I think so screening for PCOS is definitely something that we should be thinking about. But then in general, thinking about our fibrosis hat and our hepatology hat, I think like you said, the guidances are pretty good at picking up the at-risk population and who we should screen, but the interval is key. When a woman's hitting that, like that menopausal kind of change, and they have diabetes, And we didn't talk about genetics, but if I have a Hispanic woman who just kind of is transitioning into that menopause and I'm seeing a little bit of fibrosis already, I may want to be screening with VCTE or some non-invasive assessment more frequently, not like I'll see you in 3 years.
Yeah.
Let me see you in 6 months or a year when you're really in that rapid changes to see what's happening, because maybe you need intervention kind of sooner before you get to transplant, which is what we're seeing now.
Yeah, I definitely have had patients that I have seen remotely and they had no fibrosis and steatosis, and I've sent them back decade ago, we took care of things differently. And then they come back to clinic and it's an interval. They've progressed to cirrhosis and usually they've gained weight, developed diabetes, but I've never really factored into that they've probably also gone through menopause.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. So I think the recognition for clinicians is to just, you know, have that little kind of in the back of your head, like be more worried about this person right now.
Yeah.
Because if you caught them at F2, right, and then you treat them, you know.
Yeah.
They'll never die of liver disease.
So, you know, I mean, I think medicine has always been a team sport. But do you think that our OBGYN colleagues, who are the primary care providers for the majority of women in this country, do you think they have sufficient awareness of this? This doesn't seem to be a group, you know, we're educating endocrinologists, we're educating cardiologists. Do we think we should be educating OBGYNs, particularly around the issues of MASLD risk that are particular to women?
Yeah, I definitely think we should. I think that we are starting to. I think ACOG is getting a little bit, involved in this, but not nearly as much as we should. Because like you said, they're PCP. Mm-hmm. So basically, if you're the PCP, then you need to do what a PCP would do. And a PCP would take the at-risk population if the patient has pre-diabetes or, you know, diabetes and central adiposity, et cetera, at least do the standard screening like the FIB4 and then VCTE or ELF or whatever you have available, quite honestly, if you have shear wave elastography and, you know, it's not ideal, but do something. I think for sure we need to engage them more in taking, you know, partnering with us in identifying these patients. I mean, I think, you know, in the pregnancy state, it's hard to do too much in 9 months anyway. And I feel like it's so complicated in that time frame. I feel as though in the postpartum state, those that had weight gain just, you know, they need to be even thinking more about doing that screening earlier. And I don't know the best way to engage them. The other way is to empower the patients, being more, kind of really getting women to understand their risks and, you know, calculate your own FIB4, like know your FIB4 and then bring it to the physician and say, you know, what do you think about this? We ask them to do that to their PCP. So if their OBGYN is their PCP, then like bring it to them. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you said something though, like when we started this conversation, that our patients who have fatty liver disease, MASLD, and are pregnant also have an increased risk of diabetes, but also preeclampsia, some things that we would treat differently. I think our patients that are at risk for preeclampsia, we give aspirin to, right?
Yeah.
At some point, we're going to hit a baseline prevalence of fatty liver disease or MASLD in a childbearing group where you might add screening for fatty liver disease or steatosis in that pregnancy evaluation. Because you could argue you would take care of a patient differently if they had MASLD and they were pregnant than a non-MASLD patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did mention that there's the increased fetal risk out of the gate if you have MASH or MASLD. So definitely FibroScan is now FDA approved to be done in pregnant women. So it's certainly safe and is something that can be done. And starting aspirin at 12 weeks, you know, is a recommendation in patients who have MASH. So certainly pushing for that screening makes complete sense. I just don't know how much we just need to, I mean, that is a huge educational campaign that would need to be done.
Well, I also suspect some data behind it. I still remember trying to incorporate hepatitis C testing in a pregnant population, which was painful. The discussion, not the implementation per se. So I think that to add screening and education for yet another liver disease in a pregnant or contemplating pregnancy population could be challenging.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely ideal. And the key is, I think, there's something you can do about it. So if there was nothing you could do, then it'd be a harder sell. But the fact that you would start aspirin earlier, and so the selling point, I guess, is to protect the baby too, right? Like, and that there could be decreased risk there. So I think that we definitely need to be, you know, beating on that drum more. Let's talk a little bit about what the screening is, right? What's a FIB-4? And I think, I think one really important point is that women in particular have been told that they have just fatty liver disease for like 20 years, 30 years. I think more so than men. They get the like, oh, you just have a touch of fatty liver. You have a little fatty liver. Don't worry about it. I think they get that more often. And so I think empowering women to recognize that this is a potentially very serious disease and that they need to advocate for themselves by saying, you know, if they get an ultrasound, right? Like you get an ultrasound for whatever reason, and then it says steatosis, like, you know, then calculate your FIB-4. Calculate your FIB-4 and advocate for yourself and bring that to the attention to whoever your caregiver is.
Yeah, I think that that's another place where guidelines and, you know, literature has evolved, and maybe there are providers, especially a provider who doesn't do primary care in a diverse population, may not recognize that we now have treatments, that we now have easy staging tools. And so, Mina, we've talked a lot about FIB-4. FIB-4 is probably not the only screening tool, but, you know, why don't you remind us of who we should screen, which is not just pregnant women and perimenopausal women, and how we do it and kind of what you would do with those results, because it's not one and done. We've talked a little bit about interval assessment, but, you know, what do you use and when do you use it?
Yeah. I mean, I think FIB-4 is really meant to be large-scale population screening, high negative predictive value, so that, you know, you and the at-risk population being those living with diabetes, prediabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, specifically high triglycerides or low HDL, and particularly that central adiposity. I think we've learned over the years that BMI is not as good as waist circumference. People don't do it, but you can do the eyeball test, you know, like waist circumference kind of eyeball test. And so that population, and then abnormal liver enzymes without, after you screen for hepatitis C and hepatitis B and other causes of liver disease, and then incidental steatosis on imaging, right? So these are the group that you want to say there's definitely lipid accumulation in the liver, and therefore we should do a FIB-4. So the FIB-4 includes age, AST, ALT, and platelets. And so a score of 1.3 or less would be considered low risk. But as you said, Nancy, you're low risk today doesn't mean you're going to be low risk tomorrow. So longitudinal changes over time are much more important than like a single cross-sectional view. But in a large, so less than 1.3 And we can talk about diabetes in particular. But if you're greater than 1.3, you need something with a better positive predictive value, a better rule in. And that's where the sequential testing helps. Enrich the population with a higher likelihood and then bring in your second test. And the options include if you have a VCTE or vibration control transient elastography, trademark name being FibroScan, that, you know, is available to some, but that measures liver stiffness, and liver stiffness can be from many things, including inflammation, but also scarring or fibrosis. But if you don't have access to that, there's blood-based biomarkers like the Enhanced Liver Fibrosis Test. That's a proprietary test, but it's available through LabCorp or Quest. And a score there, while it was originally FDA approved as a prognostic, meaning that if your score is greater than 9.8, you're at high risk for having a progression to cirrhosis and liver-related events. If your ELF is greater than 11.3, you have a high risk of having decompensation events. But now, because it's included in all the algorithms, we're learning what those cutoffs might be to be consistent with the F2 or F3 fibrosis that would make you eligible for therapies. And I think we're kind of right now landing at 9.2 to 10.5. And less than 9.2, you'd be kind of in that low risk group. So these are the kind of, and then I mentioned, ultrasound is available kind of even in rural areas, and shear wave elastography. What the issue is that there's a lot of heterogeneity in the software that's used. The cutoffs are a little bit unclear. The programs that, you know, it's a little just inconsistent. I think one of the areas that the field could improve on is bringing better standardization, because it is quite scalable, but also measures liver stiffness. So I think that once you have that initial assessment, then interval, depending on how many risk factors you have and how, where you are in that continuity of life, you know, you might be doing annual assessments up to maybe 2 or 3 years every time you're doing some kind of assessment for fibrosis. And then, you know, we can talk about the therapies, the FDA approved therapies, but just lifestyle, like what are the lifestyle modifications that one might make, irrespective of where you are in that continuum of fibrosis, being a, you know, for the audience that may not. So fibrosis, you know, on a stage of 0 to 4, 4 being cirrhosis, 0 being no fibrosis, and 2 and 3 kind of in between, irrespective of where you are with fibrosis, you want to treat the steatosis as well, right? Because if you get rid of the steatosis, you won't get the fibrosis, because the injury is coming from kind of lipotoxic species. So in terms of management, what can everybody do? Well, exercise and weight loss. Many have been told that their whole life, but no matter what, the reality is it works. Weight loss works. If you lose 5% of your body weight, that should improve your steatosis. If you do have MASH, the more inflammatory phenotype, then 7% weight loss can reverse that, and 10% weight loss has been shown to reverse fibrosis. So no matter whether you qualify for therapies, you want to have those kinds of goals in mind. In terms of diet, we recommend a Mediterranean style diet. No ultra processed foods, no fructose containing, that corn syrup that you see in sodas or other processed foods. I say to patients, fructose is the devil. You know, it goes to and it creates the lipids in the liver. So no matter what, these are things that we can recommend to our patients. And exercise, independent of weight loss, I think is so important. Like I say, let's not get hung up on that scale. Let's improve your muscle mass. Let's, you know, get your cardiovascular status better, because that will correlate with better outcomes, liver and cardiac, independent of weight loss. So let's not, you know, beat ourselves up if we didn't lose that percentage of our body weight. And then the therapies, right? So the two FDA-approved therapies are semaglutide at the 2.4 milligram dose once a week, and then resmetirom, which is an oral pill once a day, either with or without food. That works on the concept that MASH is driven by intrahepatic, so local low thyroid in the liver. So intrahepatic hypothyroidism, and it's a thyroid hormone receptor beta that basically restores thyroid hormone signaling in the liver. So those are the two approved therapies. The side effects, I think, you know, for the semaglutide, both cause GI predominant side effects. For semaglutide, constipation, nausea, obviously early satiety, that's how you lose the weight, you feel less hungry, works both in the GI and then in the brain to make you take the food noise away, I guess is the good way to say it. And then and resmetirom also GI side effects, nausea, diarrhea, but usually goes away after about 12 weeks of treatment, usually doesn't cause treatment discontinuation.
I also found it's important, especially for my patients that are taking GLP-1s, to talk about the fact that they still do need to eat. I'll have patients that come in and they eat like every other day because they're never hungry. And what we don't want is to add to that sarcopenia for our patients.
Right. So along with that, the resistance training, right? If you're going to, you want to be doing that resistance training, and it doesn't mean you have to go to the gym and start hitting the heavy weights, but I just tell people to get the resistance bands and, squats, just get up from a chair, you just have to use it or lose it. So I say, you don't want to lose all this muscle mass along with the fat. You want to lose the fat and preserve the muscle, because we know muscle is so important also for glucose and lipid metabolism. So it's another organ that we need to think about.
And probably especially for women, because I don't know, maybe you and Kim are not losing your muscle mass, but I think that I am not as strong as I used to be when I was younger. And I think that women do get a little bit more prone to sarcopenia than their male counterparts.
100%. And you see that in liver transplant as well, right? Like the women are the sarcopenic, they're MELs. That's why the creatinine, right, isn't as good because of loss of muscle mass.
You know, I want to say that I was, and I don't know where this was published, but they looked at the percent muscle loss with dieting. Okay, so when you diet, we know you lose muscle as well as fat. And compared that to the muscle loss that you see with the GLPs, and it was similar. So although I perceived that the muscle loss was greater with GLP medications, it doesn't appear to be true. Now, the struggle that I have is I ask every patient who comes into my clinic, in addition to the prescription that they've been given, what they've been instructed to do. And the answer is nothing. They have never been instructed on protein intake. They've never been instructed on resistance training or exercise. And that's a problem because literally, I mean, so many of my patients now are on these medications, and we know the increased risk, particularly in our advanced liver population. So we would never be able to get patients to exercise before. So what do we think is our ability to get them to do resistance training now? Certainly yeah. It's zero if we don't tell them to do it. But
it's
really important.
Yeah, I just say you want to lose the fat and keep the muscle.
Yeah.
It's more like preservation. That's what I say. But you're right. So Kim, we initially were like sarcopenia, like that it's worse with, but even if you 25% of your weight loss at least is going to be muscle mass anyway, right? Especially if you do nothing, right? So the key is how do you preserve the muscle and make the body just burn the fat? And that would be right? Perfect. So I just appeal to like that logic.
Well, and you should show them pictures of like the Ozempic face, right? I mean, you can, we really struggle with individuals who I know from a personal standpoint, they want to lose the weight because they've carried extra weight all of their life, but they don't perceive themselves as looking unhealthy, even though they look unhealthy to others.
I know that in clinic, we often have 15 minutes. It's like a primary care clinic, right? To accomplish 101 different things. There are a lot of online resources for both diet and exercise. And we're spoiled because we have in our subspecialty pharmacy, we have a pharmacist who just does GLP-1 and they do the educational component. Because even if you tell your patients all about exercise and diet and you prescribe a drug, they remember so little when they leave the appointment. And so they need that, like, oh, so we need to do dose escalation. How are you doing? What are you eating? How much are you exercising? One of our local physical therapy groups also does behavioral training, a lot of diet, because like, unless you're a diabetic, sometimes you can't get nutritional advice. So some of the physical therapy groups are integrating some of these lifestyle modifications, and they made, it's like an advertisement for them, but they made like, you know, like five exercises that people can start with, just a little handout for me. And it has their information on it, but we pass that out. Rush probably doesn't like me to pass that out. It's a branded piece of information, but we pass that that out for our patients who need those visual reminders. Like, yes, we did talk to you about the importance of physical, conditioning.
Yeah, that brief check-in, like, because you know you're going to have to dose escalate, right? So that's a great opportunity to remind. And we know human nature, right? Like if you know you're accountable to somebody, you're like, oh shiest, I'm supposed to do my 10,000 steps or whatever, and they're going to ask me about it. And you know, I mean, and then hopefully you love it so much, you feel so good that it's positive reinforcement. I mean, I know, you know, I know Nancy, you like to, you know, we like to exercise because it makes us feel good. So the hope is, you know, you feel better, you know, but, and you're right. And the reminding of the protein intake, you know, and giving that education is important. Yeah.
Well, Mina, this was really insightful. And I think I need to go to the conference that you and Kim were sitting at, where you learned so much about how women are different than men and we can't not use male data to determine efficacy and outcomes for a disease that affects both women and men. But if you want to leave a couple of messages for our listeners, some key takeaways, that would be wonderful.
Sure. So I think that certainly MASH is something for you to be aware of, MASLD. Know what risk factors you have that may put you at risk for MASLD or MASH, specifically diabetes. That's the biggest one. You know, diabetes is the single most important risk factor in those that have more significant fibrosis. So certainly, but in addition, obviously, if you're living with obesity, have high cholesterol, hypertension, kind of the increased waist circumference, then you should be advocating for yourself. Do your own Fib4, which is really easy to calculate on your phone. If you look up Fib4 in the MD calculator, you can calculate it. If it's that greater than 1.3, you want to bring that to the attention of your physician. Then along your continuum of life, in pregnancy, if you have those risk factors, you know, maybe your OBGYN may want to screen you for MASLD or MASH because there are medications that potentially could be started during your pregnancy, to such as aspirin at 12 weeks to decrease the risk of you having preeclampsia and then potentially impact on your babies. And then you're going along, living your life, raising your kids, and then, you know, you lose your, you go into menopause. And that's where you start to get all the diseases that men, you know, we kind of catch up to men in many ways, and that includes liver disease. And you have an increased risk of liver fibrosis at that time. And so you want to, step up your game in making sure that you advocate for yourself with your physician to be screening you for significant fibrosis, as I said, if you have those risk factors.
Thank you so much, Mina. And I guess I would add that the story on hormonal replacement therapy is changing, so that if you are someone who might be interested in that, talking to your clinician, because earlier probably has more benefit than trying to start hormonal replacement therapy years after you've already gone through menopause.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you have been listening to Liver Lineup, Updates and Unfiltered Insights with Kim Brown and Nancy Rowe and our special guest, Mina Bonsall, today. And so thank you so much. We are all a little smarter.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.